Taylor Decker's on my all 22 fantasy team.
Stop. They don't care.
So the strategic component to this game is through the roof.
Your predictions, right? Your forecasting in fantasy football into how good is this player?
This is going to, it's going to change the industry.
Yeah. I moved to the old town where it goes down. Look at me now. I wrote my goals down. I hold it down. Made myself proud. Say, look at me now.
What's up, everyone? Welcome into the All 22 NFL podcast. You have Chris and Ray. We're back at it after a weekend of amazing football games. Weather in New York is brutally cold. Ray, how are you doing?
It's been a week, Chris. I'm in full just like ball coach mode. Hoodie, sweats, no shave, no haircut, just ball coach mode. Straight ball coach.
All right. Well, anyway, Ray, playoffs this weekend, there was a lot of noteworthy performances that I think we should take a few minutes to talk about before we get to the meat and potatoes. First game was Houston beating the Chargers. In reality, neither quarterback looked good in this one. I think the standouts were Nico Collins had an amazing game. Laremy Tunsil did really well against a very strong Chargers pass rush, 79.3 pass blocking grade for him. Ladd McConkey probably continues his Hall of Fame bid with a 91.6 game grade to get over 190 receiving yards as well. You know, I'm going to sit here today and say, you know what, Ray, I think we got that one right.
Yeah, I mean, we called him great, but boring. He wasn't even boring this weekend either. He was just great. So good for him. Another feather in our cap. I'll take it.
Absolutely. Stingley and Lassiter as well. Where do they rank now in terms of top duos at corner in the NFL? At this point, I feel like it's got to be top four, maybe even higher.
Yeah, they're definitely up there, because the best part is there's upside there, right? There are some duos that may be performing very well, but your top guy's 28 years old or something to that effect. And Stingley and Lassiter are going to be Stingley and Lassiter for the next, 6 years plus. So that's a heck of a foundation for any defense. Stingley was targeted 10 times, which, again, versus the Chargers is a lot. Just in general, it's a lot, but especially against a team like the Chargers. He allowed 5 catches for 62 yards, but 2 picks. So if your quarterback goes 5 of 10 for 62 yards and 2 picks, it's a pretty bad day for your quarterback, right? So another just great performance for Stingley. I think it was like a 94.9 coverage grade or something coming out of the game. So kudos to him on a fantastic performance. And yeah, man, to your point, that's a heck of a cornerback duo right there.
It might not be Surtain and Snow Leopard, but it's pretty close. Oh my gosh. It's pretty close.
Definitely above those guys.
Baltimore beats Pittsburgh, and I just wanted to make a note of how good Lamar and Derrick Henry really are. TJ Watt, Nick Herbig, Minkah Fitzpatrick. Three of the top defenders in the NFL, TJ Watt, Minkah Fitzpatrick, probably top five at their position, maybe undoubtedly top five at their position, all had sub-55 graded games. TJ Watt, I don't think, has had a sub-55 graded game in a long time. And he does that against what is the toughest quarterback running back duo to defend in the NFL with Lamar's escapability and running threat. So just again, just to show how special those guys are, I'm happy for Lamar. He's continuing to kind of make a name for himself as a true playoff caliber quarterback, not just the regular season MVP.
Yeah, there's two main takeaways here, but the lasting image I have from this game is that Derrick Henry run where you see Lamar carrying out his fake to the left and three Steelers, all first, second, and third level of the defense, are following him left, and Henry just has this massive lane to work with to seal the game. We've spoken about the mobile quarterback impact on running backs and its impact throughout the year, but I've never seen it more crystal clear than it was against the Steelers this past weekend. And that I'm sure you've seen it on Twitter and anywhere else, social media, what have you. That frame just sort of epitomizes what we're talking about here and the impact, the gravity that someone like Lamar Jackson has. But also, I don't think we were potting back here, but we might have talked about him on our way to this draft, which is ironic because he wasn't even drafted. But Ardarius Washington for the Ravens, was safety six in the NFL for the year and just can cover his tail off, 85.6 overall coverage grade, right? He was undrafted in 2021, but only because he's 5'8", 177 pounds. I think when we were talking about him in general, if you just watched him in college, if he was 4 inches taller and 20 pounds heavier, he'd be a bona fide top 10 pick. I mean, it was his tape was that good, but he was 5'8", 177. But moves like that, pickups like that, undrafted free agent, Ardarius Washington, that's why the Ravens stay so good for so long. Beginning in week 8, he became the starter at safety for them after Eddie Jackson and Marcus Williams just were not working out at all, and he just never looked back. After week 8, he was safety 3 in the NFL. So they basically plugged and played a borderline all-pro safety onto their defense for the second half of the season. And he came up big again this past weekend. And just in general, just another move that the Ravens make that just seemed to work out. They just, at every stage of the team building process, it just seems like great players. You can't just say that they fall into their lap because the Ravens keep making those moves and doing the right thing. But it's just another example of them finding players at every stage of the team building process. And Ardarius Washington is just the very latest example of that. Phenomenal year, phenomenal player. And yeah, 5'8", 177. Good for him.
Yeah, he obviously is a special athlete because that's basically my size. Linderbaum and Likely are the other two names. I just wanted to give a shout out for the Ravens. 86.5 grade for Linderbaum, 82.3 for Likely. They had fantastic performances. Then moving to the Buffalo win over Denver, there was a ton of storylines I could have kind of like highlighted here. I'm just going to touch on them all. Bo Nix should be really proud of not just the performance he had this game, but his season performance overall. But this game specifically, 85.2 grade in the loss, was not all on his shoulders. So, you know, as a quarterback, I think that should give you some confidence as a rookie. Josh Allen just kind of proves again that he's a different class of quarterback. He is in that elite group of maybe three with him and Mahomes and Allen, maybe four if you include Burrow. But, you know, it's a different class where they could go into any game and just outmatch a playoff caliber team in Denver. Von Miller got his revenge game, 88.6 grade for him. And then also a big game on the other side for Zach Allen, 2 sacks for him, 77.2 grade. Anything you want to talk about there?
It was almost like a straightforward game in the sense that Buffalo just overwhelmed Denver with the strength of a better roster. Like, yeah, early in the game, Sean Payton scripting some plays, great coach, it works. And then after that, it's pretty much over. You said it, Von Miller, 4 hurries. Josh Allen is just Josh Allen doing Josh Allen things. But Buffalo had 9 starters on offense grade above 69 for the game, which means at least, so 9 players at least above average, some of them well above that. That's just overwhelming. That's almost the entire unit. So when you have that, it's just a constant, it like waves of talent just coming at you, and over the course of a game wears you down and grinds you out. And that's really what it was. There was nothing that Denver could really do as a staff to counteract that. It's just the better team won over the course of 60 minutes of football. And that's all there is to it. They were the better constructed roster. We've talked about Denver's roster construction numerous times on this podcast. For them to even get here is a testament to that staff and those players stepping up. But Buffalo just overwhelmed them. And it really just comes down to that.
It does. Philly beats Green Bay. I'm going to fly through this one because the wounds are too fresh. But
I have something here. I was like, just let Chris go for 10 minutes.
No, I don't want to talk about this game. The Philly defensive front was just absolutely too much for the Packers. N'Kobe Dean had a 90.3 grade. It's very unfortunate to see that he had a major injury and is going to miss not just the rest of this postseason, but probably a lot of next year as well. Jordan Davis had an amazing game, 89.5. Nolan Smith had 2 sacks and a 76.5 grade. Zach Bond, 73.3. Their defensive front is special. We've known that. Think about it. I didn't even mention Jalen Carter on this list. That's how good this front was. And the Packers, just interior of the offensive line, Jenkins gets hurt, so their guard gets hurt. He's out and just invited a ton of pressure with his absence. Josh Myers got hurt at the end of the game, but he looked really bad throughout the game. That's really a group that the Packers just need to figure out in the draft. I was having a conniption watching the game, thinking about that that Morgan, who we drafted to be our kind of tackle guard hybrid, just being on IR, not being available, and what a difference Zach Frazier would have made in this interior unit, and how he was a second round draft pick, not even a first. We could have had both of them, right, if you really fell in love with one guy. But I think that's been the main downfall of the Packers overall, is guys that you know are going to be good in the NFL. Cooper DeJean is another example of that, that we decide, and I could go back years, like Cody Mauch is an example of a guy that I really liked in the second round. There was a ton of guys in that draft that I'm not going to be able to pull up off the dome. But we just consistently will be in a position to draft one of those guys and make our team better. But instead, we just try to be too smart and move back. Or we try to draft the project guard tackle swing hybrid instead of getting the Cooper DeJean, who could be our cornerback one in place of Jaire Alexander, who doesn't play football anymore, supposedly, right? Or getting Zach Frazier to be our center and actually have a stalwart at center for the first time in 6 years. Like moves like that, I don't know how you talk yourself out of just getting good football players as consistently as the Packers do. Saying that, the Packers on defense did have performances from their rookies in Edgerrin Cooper. The linebacker had a 78.4 grade, but the ups and downs throughout the year with him just show that dynamic athlete that they want, while it works out some games, other games it just doesn't, and he just bombs. Javon Bullard, the safety, had one of the best games of his season with a 75.6 grade. I like to see his development. Evan Williams, the other safety who the Packers had actually played a lot more throughout the year, had a 63.4. So there is some promising performances on the defensive side of the ball from the rookies they drafted, but it hasn't been consistent. And it also isn't really necessarily in the places where it's going to be do or die for your team, right? Linebacker is kind of a bonus. Safety is kind of a bonus. But when you don't have a cornerback one, when your interior of your offensive line is not blocking for your quarterback, it's hard to have sustained success in the league today. Also, your wide receivers, right? You were playing with backup wide receivers the entire game. Packers still have not drafted a first-round receiver in the longest stretch in the NFL, I believe. We probably have doubled every other team. That's how long it's been. So those things start to add up. And when you start to question if Jordan Love is good enough, it's really hard to do that with the interior of the offensive line that's playing in front of them and playing with kind of like this modge podge group of receivers, which I like, but doesn't really offer you that next level athleticism that other quarterbacks in the league really benefit off of. Was that enough for you?
Yeah, that was good. That was perfect. I think the question, if we're going to stay on the Packers here for a bit before looking at the Eagles, the question with the Packers is, who are your anchor players, right? Okay, you have Jordan Love, you signed him to a contract, and yes, you look at your receivers and you say, hey, we drafted Jaden Reed, worked out pretty well. You know, Christian Watson, when he's healthy, he can kind of take the top off of defense.
He's never healthy. He is never healthy.
Never healthy. Dobbs shows some good things. Dontavian Wicks has some flashes. Like, oh, you know, you start talking about this quantity of these guys are pretty good, you know, good player here. But who are your anchors on that roster, especially on the offense, that you surround yourself with Jordan Love? Because you can, there could be multiple schools of thought on Jordan Love and his overall level of play and his position in the hierarchy of quarterbacks in the NFL. But even if you have a positive opinion of Jordan Love and think very highly of him, I don't think anyone can sit here and argue he is at the level of a Patrick Mahomes or Josh Allen, where he can go out there and if he has just a C plus level group of targets and pass catchers, he can go out there and win any game for you and get you through a full playoff run to the eventual Super Bowl championship, right? I don't think anyone can argue that point in favor of Jordan Love, at least not at this stage of his career. So who are your anchors? You know, on the offensive line, it's like, okay, we found Rashid Walker. We might have something there. Elgton Jenkins has been a solid piece that we've moved around a lot over the years between tackle and guard as needed. He's filled in admirably, solid player, glue guy. That's great. But who are your
anchors? Zach Tom. Zach Tom is really
good. You
would
say Zach Tom, but
we found a diamond in the rough.
Even then, he's emerging. It's a That's a diamond. Who's a no-brainer guy? I mean, you look at the Eagles. Lane Johnson's been there for a decade. He's anchored that offensive line for a decade now. Darius Slay's declining, but Darius Slay has been an anchor on that defense for several years as they've added guys like Jalen Carter, Jordan Davis, Nolan Smith. As they've added talent, they've had those anchor players. It feels like no one's really anchoring the Packers on that side of the ball. You have Jordan Love. You have, you know, a collection of pretty solid receivers who give you a little something here and there. And you have Josh Jacobs. And that's it. But the spine of that offense, it's, like you said, it's weak on the interior. And in the playoffs, that is magnified. I think that's what really just sets up, you know, aside from the injuries and everything else that went wrong, it just sets up the offense for failure when you go up against a team, especially with a front as talented as the Eagles, where now if you look at the Eagles and turn your attention to them, they survived a really bad Jalen Hurts game. Jalen Hurts has these games, and this was one of them. I mean, midway through the third quarter, he had like 40 yards passing, and they were still really never threatened. You never doubted that they were going to lose the game despite that. And when you look at why and you dig deeper, three of their four highest graded offensive players were on the offensive line. So no surprise there. We know about how good that offensive line is. It just goes to show you the type of foundation that they have on that offense that can survive a game like this. And I use the word survive because even on top of the allowed pressures and everything else, the injuries, the mistakes that the Packers were making and the mishaps to just kill drives that allowed the Eagles to get away with this type of game. So the Eagles survive. They played a C-plus game, and it was more than enough to get out of that this weekend with the win against the Packers, because there are fundamental flaws with that roster where, despite all the good things that you could point to and say, hey, we drafted three solid receivers and they all have a good role and yada, yada, yada. We found Zach Tom, Rashid Walker. You know, we kind of like our safeties. That's Cooper flashed. There's still some fatal fundamental flaws that need to be solved with the Packers roster before they can seriously contend for title. And until they can resolve that, first, second round is kind of looking like their ceiling.
So a couple things that, like you mentioned, that I just want to mention before we move on, right? So you look at young Patrick Mahomes had Tyreek Hill, prime Tyreek Hill. You look at young Josh Allen had prime Stephon Diggs. You look at young Joe Burrow had Jamar Chase and T. Higgins. Like, Lamar is the weapon himself, so I don't think he necessarily needs that, right? But like you talked about before, Lamar on a play was able to draw an entire, you know, three or four players away from the play with his skill set. But, you know, that's something Tyreek Hill was doing for the Chiefs. That's something Diggs was doing for the Bills. Something Jamar does week over week. The Packers absolutely do not have that. They do not have something that a defense really has to be scared of, right? They have good weapons. They have a bunch of different guys that have great strengths, but nobody that's terrifying, right? A terrifying player on this team makes this team really dangerous. I honestly, I just don't want to talk about it anymore. So we're going to move on to Washington, Tampa Bay, where I think two noteworthy performances here. Jaden Daniels is doing things I never really expected, right? The knock on running style quarterbacks, which I think is questionable because I think he is a good pocket quarterback as well. He's showing that, but it's that they get to the playoffs and good defenses will tear that apart, right? Especially young ones. But he went out there and won a really tough game in the last seconds, right? Like, this is a great performance for him. And then it's also the Mike Evans conversation of, I think, you know, Mike Evans is probably in that Derek Jeter conversation where throughout his career, he probably was never the number one guy. Like, he was never the highlight, but he was just consistently really good and in that top five range where, you know, for so long we were like, oh, that's probably a Hall of Famer. But now it's to the point where, okay, he's over 30. He's still having those 1,000-yard years. And in the playoffs, he is the distraction, right? Like, talking about those players, Mike Evans is that, right? He scores touchdowns in almost every game he plays in. So I think he's even entering a different part of that Hall of Fame conversation as of, is he a Hall of Famer, into, what level of Hall of Famer is he? Is he that base questionable Hall of Famer still? I don't think so. I think now it's like he's entering like the greats, which is, hey, if you're doing this another 2 or 3 years, we're going to talk about you in the top 10 conversation.
Yeah, he's getting better with age almost. I mean, he got hurt this year, missed several games, and still got 1,000 yards. Yeah, it took the final play of the game or what have you, but got 1,000 yards despite missing games due to injury this year. And you keep expecting the slowdown, and it really hasn't happened. And yeah, his impact is noticeable, and it hasn't changed with that offense. I think overall, this was a game of coaching and not just aggressiveness and time management. It just felt like Washington always had an answer. And I think a lot of people are putting the cart before the horse a little bit with Jaden Daniels because they want to make him the next Lamar Jackson. He's not. And I don't believe he ever will be. And that says more about Lamar Jackson than it does Jaden Daniels. So I think he's a tier below that at the very least when it comes to his overall ceiling and career projection. But again, we're talking about a rookie winning a playoff game. And the reason I bring him up and coaching is because on a key third down very late in the game, Tampa on defense had a double spy on Jaden Daniels. They said, this is a rookie. Okay, it's a passing down. We're going to make him pass the ball. What we're not going to do is allow him to escape and run for an easy first down. We're not going to give him 10 free yards with his legs because he's just faster than a middle linebacker or a big nickel that we put on as a spy. And Jaden Daniels said, okay, I'm going to go ahead and complete a chunk play over the middle through the air because you don't want to give me a first down with my legs, and I'll take it through the air. And he did that. They had answers on offense. They didn't just dumb things down for Jaden Daniels because he's a rookie and overly rely on his legs because of it. And I think it's major kudos to the Washington staff as far as letting him grow, but not putting him in bad situations as a rookie in a big spot like this. So overall, I think it's a masterclass in coaching. They got it done. Kudos to him, but he's not quite Lamar just yet. And that's with all respect, because I'm extremely impressed with Jaden Daniels to date.
All right. And the last game that we have to talk about is Minnesota and the Rams. The Rams come out victorious, and it was a pretty big win for the Rams. Jared Verse continues his really impressive rookie season. He had 7 hurries, 84.4 grade. I think it just goes to show that he was maybe the best, at least the most polished now edge rusher in that group of rookies. Probably the worst case scenario for Minnesota with Sam Darnold, though. You have a quarterback that shows out in the regular season and did fantastic through 16 weeks. And then in his 17th game has a 45.8 grade against the division rival Lions to lose the division. And then in the first game of the playoffs against what was one of the weaker playoff teams has a 54.9 grade. I think if you are Minnesota, you can look at this two different ways. One, we now have a very big negotiating advantage with Sam Darnold to get his cost down very low to the point where we can continue building this team, adding free agents, and making it a very good team around what is maybe, you know, a quarterback that isn't perfect, right? Or you're asking yourself, is this a guy that can ever bring us to that next level? If he couldn't do it with this team, if he couldn't do it with this offense, because the offensive weapons in Minnesota are as good as any have. It's one of the best offensive lines in football. It's one of the best receiving groups in football, if not the best receiving group in football. Good tight ends, good running backs. It doesn't get easier from here for Sam Darnold. Will experience on the team? Will experience with the guys get better? Maybe. But it's a really hard question for Minnesota to start to ask themselves.
The counterpoint to push back a little bit on that is I think the offensive line in particular, mainly due to injury, has a lot to do with this, and finally caught up with them. Sam Darnold's been bad the last 2 weeks, but two of their three lowest graded players on offense last night were their left tackle, Cam Robinson, and their right tackle, David Questenberry. If both of your tackles are the worst performing players on your offense, probably not a good night for whoever's standing back there trying to throw the football. It's just going to be the way it is, right? And you had Brian and that, and actually Brian O'Neill, you could actually lump three of their four, because Brian O'Neill before getting injured was also their third worst performing player on offense. So no matter who you had back there, was really letting up a ton of pressure and really not opening up things on the offense for Darnold or the running game to really get going much at all. We saw Aaron Jones struggle for a bit too. I think the Darisau injury really, really hurt them. And just fundamentally, yes, they were able to still scrape by and manufacture some wins after that for the majority of the season. But that was always going to be something that you worried caught up to them in the playoffs. I think quarterbacks have too much leverage in today's game for you to really negotiate a price point lower than a certain point. He's not going to get less than Baker Mayfield. He's not going to get less than Jordan Love, whether it's from the Vikings or someone else. He's going to get, Darnold's going to get paid.
You know how much Jordan Love made?
If I'm Darnold's agent and you want to play hardball with me, I'll say, okay, fine. You go ahead. Play JJ McCarthy. I hope you have a lot of crossing routes in your playbook. And then when I'm a free agent, I'm going to say, go ahead, get your quarterback in this draft. I'll be here. No one wants to do that. The league knows this is not the draft class to solve your quarterback issues either. So I think one way or the other, Darnold's going to have the leverage. I think as sort of you move further away from this loss, you're going to look at the circumstances surrounding that offense. And little by little, mainly on the offensive line, things deteriorated to the point where you could point to that and say this was a catalyst. If you have good protection, Darnold can get it done. They were in contention for the number one seed in the final week of the season until, you know, injuries caught up. That's the story that you can play. And as a quarterback, you absolutely have the leverage to get away with that. And I think it's true. I really do think, because yes, Darnold was bad, but overall that offense couldn't get anything going, and a lot of it was up front. And you can't just weaponize your way out of that at wide receiver with Jefferson and Addison and whoever else. It's still a game of blocking and tackling. And if you don't have the first part of that, it's really hard to manufacture wins against other playoff caliber teams. You could do it in week 9 against the Dolphins or something when they don't have Tua on the other sideline either. But it's another thing to do it in mid-January when you're up against a playoff team.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the NFL is catching up on the teams that were just trying to have average offensive lines. And if you don't have a good offensive line, you got destroyed this year. Like, it just wasn't a good year for you because the NFL just figures you out, right? I will also say that the Baker contract and the Jordan Love contract are like $100 million apart. I expected it to fall somewhere in between. I did not expect Sam Darnold to get Jordan Love money. I think there was a difference. I do. Maybe not, you know, you could believe that they're on the same level of play, but, you know, I'm just saying that I think there's a difference in terms of, you know, when a team drafts you and develops you and pays you, you typically get to be that highest paid player. I think if you're a on the road free agent bouncing around the league and then you have a good season, you do lose a lot of that negotiating power. I would expect him to land somewhere in that 175 million range. But saying that, even like, I do think that the best teams in the NFL with the best quarterbacks in the NFL look at the situation and say, I need my quarterback to be able to perform when things aren't perfect. And yes, the offensive line was not perfect, but like, again, when this offense is healthy, it's the perfect situation. So you're telling me Sam Darnold performed behind the perfect situation. And then once that situation, a piece of that situation broke down, he didn't. And he turned back into a pumpkin, right? Like, that's concerning to me. And I think that's what the Vikings are going to be asking themselves, is how long can we realistically expect our situation to be perfect?
So you're going to go ahead, turn it over to the 21-year-old who had nothing but perfect situations in college and has never faced anything like what you saw last night, and let me know how that works out for you.
You have to know, you have to be willing to take a
whole
risk.
Another conversation since they made the decision already, but you know, last spring. Yeah.
We'll talk about that later on, but okay. When we were doing our quarterback conversation last week, we did not expect that Quinn Ewers was going to at least verbally say that he was declaring for the draft. Is he definitely doing it? I don't think that's determined yet. But I think that since he has said it, we should have talked about him. And since we didn't, let's do that now. Okay, so Quinn Ewers, 21 years old, will be 22 on draft day, has played for Texas. He had one season at Ohio State where he didn't play, but he's played three seasons at Texas and started all three of those seasons. He's 6'2", 210 pounds. Again, three-year starter. The past 2 years, 36 big-time throws and 29 turnover-worthy plays. That is, it's not a great ratio for those of you out there counting. This year alone, 20 big-time throws, 21 turnover-worthy plays. Again, not great. 7.9 ADOT, 23.2 pressure to sack rate, 2.59 time to throw. Couple interesting things there, right? A team that has a ton of weapons and a great offensive line, you wouldn't expect that it was so fast-paced where he was getting the ball out of his hand in under 2.6 seconds. That's wild. But to get the ball out of your hands that quick and still give a pressure to sack rate of 23% and have a 7.9 ADOT, it's all kind of weird, right? With 21 turnover-worthy plays, when you're not really pushing the ball down the field, doesn't really add up to me. So the numbers like definitely make you just start asking questions from the jump. But the positives to me, he's got really active feet in the pocket. You could tell that he's had great training in pocket, a footwork in the pocket, things like that. He has a tight spiral that's very easy to catch. He might have the easiest catchable ball in the draft. It's a really nice and easy throwing motion as well. The touch is great. And I'd say he has above NFL average ball placement. So those are all like really great positives. But the negatives are definitely concerning. Besides just the numbers that we talked about, he has really bad legs, right? He doesn't run. He's not a good runner in any means. And he also has poor pocket presence. Like, yes, he has great feet and footwork within the pocket, but I can't tell you the amount of times in, you know, the three games I watched of him where he just decides to move into traffic. Like, you know, he's got a clean pocket. He panics and he just tries to step up. Again, this is not a runner. He's not trying to run, but he steps up into the traffic instead of just staying put and continuing to read what's there for him. That was a huge, huge concern of mine. I think his arm strength is overrated. I was listening to people talk about him and talking about how, you know, he has had one of the strongest arms that they'd seen as a prospect coming out of high school. Maybe it didn't develop from there. But, you know, I saw plays where he struggled to put the ball 50 yards down the field, right? There's quarterbacks in this draft that could throw it 60 or 70 yards in the air. I also, you know, another huge, huge concern for me is that there really wasn't consistency game in and game out. One performance was good. The next one was bad. The next performance was good. The next one was bad. It just doesn't add up. It's not like this guy had a really nice run of, you know, okay, he had a couple bad games in a row, then he put together seven good games and he ended the season strong. That didn't happen for Ewers, right? And this is a guy, again, that was the number one quarterback prospect that was rated since, I think, Trevor Lawrence. And for him not to really develop and still be having these fundamental issues as a three-year starter, it's concerning to me. Is there something else at play here? Is there physical limitations? Is there mental limitations? Is he not putting in the time and effort that's needed to be a great quarterback at the next level? His play reminded me a lot of Derek Carr. I think that would be my like kind of pro comp for him. Similar size, you know, doesn't have a great, you know, the greatest arm in the world, relies a lot on being in the pocket and just being accurate. And I think the right team needs to be willing to invest in the risks that come with drafting a player like Quinn Ewers, because the expectations, right? Once you say I'm drafting Quinn Ewers, the fan base is going to say, hey, that's a guy that was a five-star recruit, huge recruit out of high school. He's got the tools. We're going to turn this guy around. And at some point we want to see him play football for us. And if you're not willing to do that, that's a huge gamble. And you're going to start to create this kind of chaos. How concerned should we be with his performance and like with the team that he had? We're talking about a team that had two potential first round tackles, a couple receivers that will be drafted in the top three rounds. It's a really good offense that he played in. Right now, I have him as kind of a third round pick in that range. I have him after Cam Ward. So he would probably be my quarterback four before like a Jalen Milroe. But again, I talked about how Jalen Milroe is probably not an NFL quarterback. So, you know, if you're taking a risk on Quinn Ewers at all, it's probably going to be somewhere around the third round. But want to hear your takes.
So when I was studying and watching Quinn Ewers, I kept thinking back to, he kept reminding me of this one pro quarterback in the league today. This name kept coming up. I don't know why I didn't think to do this before, but just now I Googled that name, went to his NFL scouting report, and I'm going to read it to you. I'm not going to mention the name, the strengths and weaknesses. I want you to tell me if this is relatively in line, which it seems to be based on what you said, but I want to hear your take on this, right? Throws with accuracy and hits receivers in stride when feet are set. Has some experience in a pro-style attack, clean footwork and drop back and setup. Mechanics of footwork are solid, patient in allowing routes to develop. Throws with above-average touch to all levels. Plays with adequate pocket mobility. Plays with relative calm once he's freed from the pocket, willing to play with pain. Weaknesses, unimpressive frame build. Injured his throwing shoulder in, I won't give away the years. Foot quickness from the pocket is very average, not threatening arm strength, doesn't have a hose for target practice in tight windows. Short arms, too many attempts. Sometimes decision-making will lead to interceptions. Roughly high level in line.
The only thing I would say is different is I think that his pocket, like moving the pocket, is not above average or not average. It's below. Everything else is very close.
I would agree with that. That was Jake Browning. That's the name that came to me as I watched him just over and over again. I'm like, this is Jake Browning. And I couldn't get it out of my head. And that's exactly who he is. Jake Browning went undrafted. How would we be talking about Quinn Ewers if his name was, you know, Adam Smith and he was a high three-star recruit from nowhere, Texas, as opposed to his heralded five-star with a mullet who went to every camp and was super hyped up as a teenager and all that other, you know, fun stuff. I don't know. I think Jake Browning should have been drafted. I like Jake Browning. I have a couple of shares of him in some leagues, as you know. But I think that's pretty much all I see. And how do you value that guy? Is this someone you think can really start for you for 8 years? I do believe the injury to his shoulder is probably worse than was led on this past year. And it seems like that really has affected his zip on his throws. And maybe that comes back with time. I don't know. But from what I'm seeing this past season on tape, it has not come back. And so that's a concern as well. So what do you do with someone, not a dynamic athlete, not a huge frame, not a ton of zip on his passes, is putting the ball in harm's way even when he's getting rid of the ball relatively quickly? I don't know what to do with that. Again, it's just another name in a draft class full of quarterbacks that maybe outside of one, it's really hard to convince yourself that this is someone who's going to be starting for you 6 years after you draft him. I don't know what to do with that. I think he could stick around as either a back-end starter or a pretty high-end backup for several years, but I don't think he's the answer to a team's problems if they have needs at quarterback.
That's a really interesting analysis, and I like the comparison you made because, yeah, if his name was Jake Browning and he was coming into league kind of unknown, you know, you're fine taking a risk on him. You're fine putting him on your roster. But when somebody comes with kind of, I don't want to call it baggage because I don't think there's any negative connotations to Quinn Ewers like that I need to talk about. But it's just when a guy was a heralded high school prospect, has played for Texas and led them to really important games, and there was always eyes on him, I think it's really hard to draft him late and expect your fan base just to sit there and be like, okay, yeah, we got a backup. It's like, no, they're, you know, again, if you're going to draft somebody like this, you're drafting them in the third round latest because you're going to take a chance on starting him at some point. Yeah, I don't know which team that makes sense for. I think it's going to be kind of tough. You know, Giants fans are going to hate me for saying this, but if you don't get your quarterback, if there's only two, right, if you believe that it's Shador and Cam and that's it, and those guys go 1 and 2 and you're sitting at 3, you're obviously not going to take another quarterback in this draft at 3. So maybe you wait, right? And Quinn Ewers is a guy that you add to the quarterback room along with a veteran like Kirk Cousins. And you say, we're going to give this a year, see if either of them show me anything. And if not, next year, hopefully I'm in a different position and I can sell out to get my quarterback. That's kind of the situation I see it at, you know, that might work for Quinn Ewers, but otherwise, probably keeping my hands off.
Yeah, he's regressed. I think that's the scary thing is he's regressed. There seemed to be more splash to his game in 2023 and earlier than we saw this year. And that's, again, it could be the injury, but I don't know. What do you do with that? Combine, medicals, all that fun stuff will come during the draft process if he for sure goes forward with declaring for the draft and moving on to the NFL. But otherwise, it's the trend isn't comforting, put it that way.
It is not. Ray, I am still good to continue. We didn't even get into the meat and potatoes of this episode yet. We're going to talk about some coaching stuff. Are you good to keep going?
Let's do it.
All right. Awesome. So before we get into kind of like the meat of the discussion that I want to have with you, let's just talk about the coaching changes that have happened so far this offseason. So there are six teams that have fired their head coaches throughout the year leading up to now. The Patriots are at pick 1-4 and they fired Jared Mayo. I think that happened after our last episode. They've now already hired Mike Vrabel, who was my favorite choice of a defensive-minded head coach, like that style head coach. He was probably my top choice. So I like that for them. I do think it's kind of strange that they kind of continue to pick from the same well of coaches that have that Patriot experience. I heard they're bringing back Josh McDaniels to be OC under Vrabel as well, which is kind of shocking. Not that he, as OC, he's done a lot of good things. So like maybe you just think that, you know, he'll be fine and it had nothing to do with Belichick. But it's kind of weird. Again, they're dipping their toes in that same pool. And if you leave Jared Mayo because you think he's not good enough, it's weird to then go hire somebody again in that same kind of family. Did you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I didn't mind them going the defensive route. I think too many people would jump at the whole, hey, they have Drake May, so go ahead and get an offensive guy. But Drake May in a non-offensive friendly situation with a defensive-minded head coach has already shown that he belongs. So in that case, go ahead and get the best guy for your organization and you build from there. And if that's Vrabel, that's great. Josh McDaniels, now I start to get concerned that the thinking is a little too insular, but I guess it'll have to play out. But as far as Mike Vrabel, I don't have concerns there. There's familiarity. He's had success, and the whole defensive versus offensive minded head coach thing doesn't bother me as much. But I'll have to be convinced on McDaniels as the offensive coordinator there and how that impacts him. That's the one that we'll have to keep an eye on.
The Jags are at pick 5 and they fired their head coach in the season. So they currently aren't in a, you know, they had an interim. They're not going to keep him. So they are in the race for the head coaches that are available at 1-6. Since our last episode, the Raiders have fired Antonio Pierce. So they are looking 1-7, the Jets fired Saleh during the season. So they are looking. The Saints fired their head coach during the season. So they are looking. And at 1-10 is the Bears, who are also looking for a head coach. That is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 6 teams within the top 10 picks this year that are looking for a new head coach. 3 teams that are keeping their guys, which I think is really interesting, are the Titans, Browns, and Giants, who are pick 1, 2, and 3 in this draft. That's Brian Callahan, Kevin Stefanski, and Brian Daboll. So that kind of leads me to the discussion I want to have with you, because when I noticed I was doing something in my thinking without ever exploring it, which led to kind of this exercise that I went through, which was I don't ever want to draft a quarterback for fantasy football that's going to a team that already has a head coach that's a losing head coach, like a guy that's been with the organization for either a few years or a couple of years, doesn't even matter, but has a losing record. The team decides to keep him, and with that new with that existing coach, they draft a quarterback. That has always been a concern to me, again, without ever really looking into the information. But, you know, am I alone? I guess my first question to you, Ray, is, am I alone in that thinking? Or is that something that also goes through your head when you're, you know, drafting a rookie quarterback?
It's the exact situation that leads to quarterbacks perhaps failing or being likely to fail is a lame duck head coach, if you will, in the sense that they're on the hot seat, the seat is on fire before the season even begins, and a green rookie is supposed to come in and save the day. And if he doesn't find immediate success, now he's dealing with a regime change. that's a recipe for a disaster. That's two strikes already just before you even really take the field. It is a major concern. I think from an organizational standpoint, I understand the decision, for example, to not fire someone like a Callahan or a Daboll, right? I mean, you're going to fire someone for not being able to win games with Will Levis and Mason Rudolph. I mean, you got to give them a fair shake on one hand. But if you're going to exercise discipline, restraint, and patience on the front end, you have to exercise that same discipline, restraint, and patience on the back end, meaning you cannot, after 1 year of, you know, 6-11 or whatever it is with a rookie quarterback, then pull the plug and do a regime change and hit the reset button, because now that's harming the investment you just made in a franchise quarterback or a potential franchise quarterback 8 months prior. That's what leads you into trouble as an organization. That's what sets you back multiple years. And then you look up and you're the Browns. So yes, if you want to be patient, fine, but be all the way patient. You can't be half patient and just half bake the whole thing and then go ahead and cut your losses year one after a rookie quarterback. The Bears should have gotten rid of Eberflus before Caleb walked through the door. You should have. That was wrongful patience, because there is no way that's going to work out with Eberflus there. So now they had to pull the plug after 1 year. Now you have to hope Caleb's natural talent and whoever you bring in now can sort of overcome the natural disadvantages you put your young quarterback in with a regime change between years one and year two. So it's absolutely eyebrow raising, because everybody says the right things when they bring the coach back after a lackluster season where they might have been let go. It's another to endure 17 weeks of subpar performance as a team, as a roster, where you miss the playoffs again. It's a real gut check at that point to still be patient, because you know it's damaging to your quarterback and your investment to get rid of the head man after just 1 year. So yeah, I'm fine. Be patient. Be as patient as you want to say that you want to be right now, but do it all the way. Don't half-ass it, because that's when you get yourself into trouble.
So I hear from you that you also had that kind of assumption. So like, without the data, you didn't have the data, I didn't have the data, but I got the data. And at some point I'm going to publish this so that people don't have to like write this down while they're listening to the podcast. They could just enjoy. But I'm going to give kind of the answer to the question before I give the data, because there's a lot of data. It could be a little confusing. So like, just for clarity's sake, there were 26 quarterbacks between 2015 and 2022 that were drafted in the first round. So 26 times teams thought, this is my opportunity in the first round to get my quarterback between 2015 and 2022. The reason I'm not talking about 2023 or 2024 is because we don't really have outcomes of those situations yet. It's too fresh to really accurately articulate the effects of the decisions that the teams made. But okay, so 26 times. 9 of those times, coaches were existing on the team and had a losing record when the team drafted the quarterback. So we're saying that the picks 1, 2, and 3 this year all are in that situation where they have their coach, they're keeping that coach, they're expected to draft a quarterback, and the coaches all have losing records. That's happened 9 times previously in, what did I say, 8 years. In 8 years, that happened 9 total times. It's going to happen 3 times this year, potentially. 9 times. Of those 9 times, 8 of those coaches were fired after before the third season of that rookie quarterback's career. 5 of the times they were fired immediately. 3 of the times they were fired after the second year. And that happened with the Browns, that happened with the Dolphins. So if you expect these 3 coaches to keep their job after next year, you have a 1 in 9 shot, essentially, of that happening. And Ray, little trivia, do you know what team held that coach? So coach had a losing record. They drafted their quarterback. That coach still has his job.
I feel like the first answer that came to my mind was Mike Tomlin, but I don't think they had a losing record when they drafted Pickett. I think they probably were 500 or just above it.
So this is not saying that it's the team's record, it's the coach's record. So in terms of like Mike Tomlin, Mike Tomlin is one of the most winning coaches of all time. So he definitely wouldn't be that coach.
Got it. I thought you meant just the previous season. Then I'm out. Then I'm out of answers.
Zach Taylor. Zach Taylor is the one coach that had a losing record before the team drafted their quarterback. And what, again, career losing record as a head coach. And he's kept his job through it. Every single other one of those coaches has lost their job. That's pretty telling to me that while I think that there are situations, we've said this before, right? Like a coach like Jared Mayo drafts his quarterback, and I think he did his job, which is prove that Drake May is the future of the franchise. Them firing him doesn't necessarily mean that he had a negative effect on Drake May's development. But I think more often than not, that is the case, right? Where these coaches that have losing records are keeping their job, drafting these quarterbacks, have a negative impact on the rookie quarterback. I think Tua is a great example of that, where, you know, coach had a losing record. They let him stay. They draft Tua, and he kind of mentally destroyed Tua a little bit. And, you know, he hasn't gotten another head coaching job, although he's probably the best defensive coordinator in football right now. So really interesting, but let's start to go through the numbers and we can talk about some of the things, right? So I said, I looked at 2015 to 2022. There were 26 quarterbacks taken in the first round in that time. 54% of those quarterbacks are considered busts. Jameis Winston, Marcus Mariota, Carson Wentz, Paxton Lynch, Mitchell Trubisky, Sam Darnold, Josh Rosen, Daniel Jones, Dwayne Haskins, Zach Wilson, Trey Lance, Justin Fields, Mac Jones, Kenny Pickett. And I know you're sitting at home saying you guys have been talking about how great Sam Darnold is. Why is he on your list? The way I kind of judge this is, did the quarterback get a second contract immediately after his rookie contract expired or before it expired? The answer for all of those quarterbacks is no. I think Carson Wentz maybe did, but he didn't even stay with the team.
And they couldn't get out of it fast enough.
Right. And they couldn't get out of it fast enough. So I am including him on this list. So next thing I'll say here. So 14 busts, right? 14 busts. That's 54% of drafted first round quarterbacks are considered busts. It's more than half. 64% of those 14 busts had the head coaches fired before their second professional season. So these could have been old coaches. These could have been coaches in their first year. 64% of those coaches lost their job before year two. So just again, looking at the numbers, if your team drafts a quarterback and they are a bust, you are more than likely to lose your job the next year. The five head coaches, only five, that retained their jobs after drafting a bust quarterback have a combined record of 638 and 428 with 14 Super Bowl appearances and 8 wins. Obviously, Bill Belichick is included in that list, right? They drafted Mac Jones in the first round. He survived a couple of years, but eventually did get fired. Doug Peterson won a Super Bowl with his team, eventually got fired. Robert Saleh, don't know why they kept him, but they did. They decided he was a guy they wanted to continue to take a chance with. He's been fired. The two that have remained with their team even after this. So of the 14, only two still have their job. 64% lost their job after the first year. The other three lost their job in subsequent years. Two still have their job. That's Kyle Shanahan, who got Brock Purdy in the seventh round, and that saved him probably. And it's Mike Tomlin, who again is the most, you know, I think percentage-wise, the most winning head coach of all time. Any thoughts on that before I continue?
My only thought on that is it that if you draft a bust, you lose your job, or is your ship already sinking? You bring someone on board and then you throw the captain overboard and then everybody else still just sinks because the damn thing was already, you know, taking on water when you brought in a young quarterback, which goes back to, I think, what Kevin O'Connell said, organizations fail young quarterbacks more than young quarterbacks fail organizations. It's the other way to look at it. So I think if someone were to describe what you mentioned between the Giants, the Browns, and the Titans, as far as retaining their head coaches and picking the top three of the draft, if you draft a quarterback, your worry is, did I just bring someone onto a sinking ship? Or are they actually going to see this thing through? I think that's the the flip side of the coin as far as how do you want to look at this data. But either way, it's not good if you fire the damn coach.
No, it's not, right? So essentially, the next thing I have here, you know, just to kind of clarify what I said before, right? So if you draft a quarterback and they are a bust, you're more than likely to lose your job. And if you don't lose your job, you will in the next couple of years. Again, only two coaches out of 14 kept their job to this day. Only two. Breaking it down even further, only three of the 14 coaches that drafted a bust were hired the same year that their quarterback was drafted. So the existing coach, 9 of 14 times, was there in place and the team drafted a bust. Only 3 times was it a new coach. So that tells me that maybe having the new coach will lead to not drafting a bust, not having a bust quarterback, and also the longevity of the coach that's hired. So something to consider there. Now let's look at the flip side, which is the successful quarterbacks. Between 2015 and 2022, 12 first-round quarterbacks were widely regarded as successes. That's Jared Goff, that's Patrick Mahomes, Deshaun Watson, Baker Mayfield, Josh Allen, Lamar Jackson, Kyler Murray, Joe Burrow, Tua, Herbert, Love, and Trevor Lawrence. Of those 12 quarterbacks drafted, 30% of them experienced getting their coaches fired after their rookie season. That's Jared Goff, that's Baker Mayfield, Justin Herbert, and Trevor Lawrence. Trevor Lawrence is, you know, with the Jags. I think the instability of that organization kind of speaks for itself. Baker Mayfield was drafted by the Browns. I think the same thing could be said there, right? Jared Goff, we all know the story. They traded him away and won a Super Bowl because of it, because they thought they upgraded at quarterback. And maybe they did, right, with Matthew Stafford and what they were able to do, kind of going all in on that season. But Goff has been fantastic with the Lions, so we're considering him a success here. And then there's Justin Herbert, who just lost first round of the playoffs, threw 4 interceptions, but, you know, has been a really solid regular season quarterback to this date. And finally gets the head coach that we think will be there for a long time. Okay, so that group, those 4 guys, include 3 number one overall picks. Justin Herbert, talked about some of the things there. Let's keep going. I think now let's get into kind of projections, right? So I talked about the Titans, the Giants, and the Browns. Brian Callahan just finished his first year as a head coach. He has a 3-13 record. He had a 5-game losing streak to end the season. He was the offensive coordinator for a while in Cincinnati, and he's credited with some of the development of Joe Burrow in that offense. He has the number one overall pick this year. You know, you said it earlier on, you could see a situation where you say you have to give this guy a chance because you didn't give him a chance the year before. But I think what the data clearly shows us that just having the losing coach on, you know, in the organization as part of the leadership will lead to his demise anyway, right? Like, it's time for a fresh start for him anyway. The Browns, Kevin Stefanski, I think, is the really interesting one. And he's probably the one that I would say you keep, right? He's been the head coach for 5 years with the Browns. He has a 40-43 record with 2 playoff appearances and 1 win. But I think the majority of the struggles, and if you look at his record before Deshaun Watson, it's probably a winning record, right? So you insert Deshaun Watson. Maybe they forced Deshaun Watson on him. It obviously didn't work out. You kind of ruined the integrity of the team in terms of where you're putting money. And, you know, I don't think that should be on Stefanski. So if you're telling me that you want to give Kevin Stefanski a chance to draft his quarterback and figure it out, I do think that makes sense to keep that coach.
Yeah, but the owner's not going to fire himself for injecting Deshaun Watson onto this football team. So he's not going to hold himself accountable. And I agree. I think Stefanski is a very good offensive-minded head coach. I like what he's done overall. I think that he was saddled with the Deshaun contract and everything that came with it. You see its impact as, I mean, 36, 24 months ago, we were talking about how strong this Browns roster was looking. And now you look, the offensive line is just kind of eroded. They still have some pass-catching weapons and everything, but it's not as dynamic as you expected it to be. And I think that's because they're saddled with a $270, $250, whatever the number is, million-dollar guarantee, just anchor around their neck. And I like Stefanski. I don't see how he survives, whether it's after next year or perhaps the year after that, if they give him that much rope. I just don't see it working out because the owner's not going to fire himself. And that was an owner-driven decision and move that ultimately destroyed their window. In a world without an unprecedented contract being given and handed out and handed down by an owner, I think that's one where you keep him around and a quarterback could find some success over the long term. Unfortunately, I don't think it's going to play out that way because owners have this funny thing of not holding themselves accountable. Welcome to Dallas, Deion Sanders.
Well, I think, you know, you look at Stefanski and what he's been able to do with the Deshaun Watson situation. And, you know, like before this year, they were still competing every single year, right? Like they were putting together wins. And I think that's an important thing to think about with like why Mike Vrabel got another job, why Mike Tomlin hasn't lost his job. When coaches can get you wins, hard wins with less than ideal rosters, I think those are guys that you typically bet on finding success. And, you know, Dan Quinn in Washington, I think, is a pretty interesting example of a coach that failed once before, gets put on a roster that was had a lot of holes and was kind of seen as like this roster that, you know, probably was going to take a few years. And now you insert a rookie quarterback that, you know, was intriguing, but, you know, you and I didn't think he was an elite level quarterback. And they're in the second round of the playoffs right now. So if the Browns are able to get a guy that they think is, you know, ready and competent, I could see them having that kind of a turnaround pretty quickly. It just really depends on if you hit on that quarterback, right? And what Stefanski can do with him. I do think that there's a chance that, you know, this is a Kirk Cousins led team next year with a rookie in the mix. Again, maybe Quinn Ewers or somebody like that.
It's a lot of money being tied up at that position.
It's a lot of money tied up, but, you know, he might take that team friendly. Like Russell Wilson says, you know, I'm going to let the Broncos pay my salary and I'll go to the Steelers on veteran minimum and play it out. I could see Cousin doing that to try to get himself back in the money market the year after.
That would be the way that's what I would try to do to save my job if I'm Stefanski. I don't think any of the rookies in this class can come in and really turn their ship around. And I feel bad for him. That's a tough spot to be put in because, you know, even we talked about anchors earlier in this episode, the anchors of that team, Myles Garrett's getting older. The offensive line hasn't quite worked out, but they lost so much draft capital. They haven't really been able to replenish the cupboard there. And so that window or what that window would have been, this is right around the time it was going to be closing. And to now start with, well, we'll bring in a new quarterback in 2025 and try to nudge that thing open a little bit. That's a fine line to thread. I'm not sure he's going to be able to get it done through no fault of his own.
It's going to be really tough, right? And that's what we're saying in this conversation is for all of these head coaches that are keeping their job, it's going to be very tough.
Yeah.
The Giants fans, cover your ears right now. Just do it. Cover your ears or just turn it off, right? Come back tomorrow. But
don't turn it off. Hit the subscribe button before you turn it off. Like, subscribe.
Like and follow and share. Brian Daboll has a three-year record so far with the Giants and is 18-31-1. He made the playoffs in his first year, won a wild card game. And Daboll, right, is credited with developing Josh Allen as the offensive coordinator in Buffalo. 18-31 shows me enough that this is probably the least likely scenario of a coach turning it around and hitting on the guy, right? Not destroying the next guy. Like I think it's obvious that he has shown you enough that he is not going to be keeping this team competitive. He does not have the wherewithal to keep this team competitive. And if you give him, you know, again, like Brian Burns, Thibodeau, Dexter Lawrence, drafting him a first-round corner in Banks, if you draft him Tyler Newbin, you get him all of the pieces you could ask for on defense. You draft him a number one receiver in Malik Nabers. You draft him, you know, Andrew Thomas, and you get the offensive line, and you keep investing in the offensive line, and it's just not working. That tells me that there's an issue with the coach that you have, and it's not going to work out. In my opinion, this is all speculation, but the reason he still has his job is because Mara probably is the one that wanted to pay Daniel Jones. And there was probably some kind of a deal done behind closed doors being like, we'll sign Daniel Jones. We'll try to make it work. But if it doesn't work, you have to give us 1 year to figure it out before you fire us. And I think that's what's happening right now. But this is not a coach that has proven to you that he can do that.
No, he hasn't. And I still think he's a good coach. I still think Dable is a good coach, but sometimes it doesn't work out. Good guy, nice lady. I'm not sure the Giants are a nice lady right now, because what Brian Dable walked into was just an absolute disaster. And there's no other way to put it. They were saddled with horrendous contracts from the Gettleman era. This also applies to Joe Shane, I guess. Horrible contracts from the Gettleman era. A first round draft pick at quarterback that, behind a historically poor offensive line, was perhaps broken, but you had to stick with him to see if perhaps he could put all the parts together again, and he kind of couldn't. And then you had a running back fighting for his life that otherwise could have been part of the conversation of one of the greatest of all time if he just went anywhere else instead of New York. And that was it. But you had no way out to have any sort of quick fix. You couldn't go into free agency because you had no money. You could only draft one player at a time. And whoever you drafted wasn't, at one player at a time, going to fix a historically bad offensive line through which everything else on the offensive side of the ball was dragged down. So there was nowhere to turn. Usually there's something when you take you go on to a new job for a team and an organization that has been down in the dumps. Typically, you have a high draft pick. That alone isn't usually enough to turn it around, unless it's an Andrew Luck or a Peyton Manning level quarterback or something like that at the top of the draft that you can hit on and just go, right? Josh Allen, I'm just throwing names out there. Outside of that, many of them also have some cap space, right? Because they're probably bad because they don't have a quarterback. So they weren't paying a quarterback a lot of money. So you're about to draft a quarterback on a team-friendly contract. You could go out and build your roster and get some help. Giants could do neither. They could do neither. They were saddled with Daniel Jones, and they had no money, and they had a ton of holes to fill. And by the time you just get done in one area and you're like, okay, I kind of got a pass rush now, you look, the offensive line is still bad. Now your quarterback's gone, and now your all-world running back is gone. And you got to fix that. And it's like, you're just plugging holes, and there's not enough. You don't have enough to work with to actually just hold everything together. And I think it's just a circumstance where you were essentially doomed from the start, unless Daniel Jones was like Andrew Luck, and he was not Andrew Luck. So yeah, I'm with you. I don't see how it works out. I don't see how it works out, because not only did you not have Andrew Luck to work with a few years ago, it doesn't look like you have Andrew Luck now, even if you draft a quarterback in a few months. So it's not even like you might have that. I mean, you always could have that quick impact rookie that all of a sudden saves your job. And even if you don't make the playoffs, you're 9-8 or something, and you're like, yeah, we're trending up now. Let's keep this thing rolling. That's really hard to see from this standpoint too. So I don't see it. I don't see it working out. And to your point, that's the one where you look at and you go, this is going to be a massive upset if it works out.
Yeah. And I think it's the team, when I look at all of the teams on this list, that probably has had the most trouble with player development. Right. And I named a few of the guys, but you know, you're telling me you drafted a first round corner that you believed could be a number one corner. I think they traded up for him, and he looks like he's not even startable at times. Right. They drafted John Michael Schmitz at center, who was supposed to be a really solid center prospect. He got rave reviews, and he does not look like a starting level center. Right. So if there is the consensus that the players you're drafting are good football players, and it's not even equating into, like you're saying, it's not even plugging the holes that just keep popping up, then it's coaching and it's development, in my mind, right? So I think that that's a huge issue. And again, the losing record speaks for itself. You should not give this guy an opportunity to touch your new rookie quarterback. There are three other teams that have rookie quarterback draft picks, which is the Jets, Raiders, and Saints. They all have moved on from their coaches, so they will have new coaches. I think the Jets historically bad at developing quarterbacks. So I definitely would be weary about that one. Raiders, you know, interesting situation. It definitely is going to depend on what coach they get. There are rumors they're fighting really hard to get Ben Johnson in there. Would be very interesting and probably make that an attractive destination with a decent offensive line, some decent receiving weapons as well, and a positive defense. The Saints, that's a rough one, right? This is a team that didn't have a lot of money, still doesn't have a lot of money, has a lot of aging veterans that are likely to leave in the next couple of years. They've had a hard time developing prospects as well. Brian Brisset is an example of that, and there's a ton more. You have an injury to your number one receiver that's going to sideline him for some time next year in Chris Olave. The offensive line hasn't gotten really better. That's a tough situation too. I think that one's going to give me pause as well. But again, if you get the right coach that goes in there like a Mike Vrabel type guy who can really just lay a foundation and a kind of like we talk about prospects, right? There's the floor and then there's the ceiling. You need to raise the floor on these teams, right? You need to get a coach that's willing to come in and raise the floor. If the Saints can do that, maybe. But I think, you know, based on this exercise, I think the Browns and the Raiders are the two teams that I never thought I'd say this, give me the most interest in if they draft a quarterback, taking a risk on that guy. How are you feeling?
I just had a thought, and I don't even think this quarterback is in this class, but I almost would feel more comfortable if the Saints drafted a quarterback in like round 3 or 4, and after a year said, let's see what this guy's got, than if they drafted a quarterback in the first round who presumably is better and more talented and tried to fix this thing in 2025. Like, I don't think, regardless, I don't think the depth of this class allows for it, but in general, I would almost feel more comfortable if like a Bailey Zappi, a Jalen Hurts, a Dak Prescott type of draft pick in round 3 or 4 or something like that were to happen and they saw the field in 26 than a first rounder seeing the field in 25.
Do a little bit of that quarterback meme with like Spencer Rattler and Quinn Ewers.
Yeah,
and...
but not Spencer Rattler.
Okay. All right,
if Quinn Ewers was drafted in the right place, perhaps. And then it's like, oh, maybe the shoulder gets better and who knows, maybe he grows his mullet and he becomes the guy again. Like maybe he's that guy. But I don't see a first round pick. And now that I went off on that tangent, I forgot you named a couple teams there as far as like intriguing for quarterbacks. I forget. What was that last thought you had?
Yeah. Just is there any team that specifically you're like, hey, I think that's a good situation. I don't think the coaching is a concern for me. So if they draft a quarterback in that top 10 range, is probably the guy that I feel most confident not ending up being a bust. Obviously, it matters who the quarterback is. So I'm just saying destination-wise with coaching and team.
Quarterback agnostic as far as situation goes, if we're going top 10, the problem is I am concerned about the coaching because I don't know who the coach is. Mm-hmm. It would be the Jets because I look at that offensive line and I like it. I like Olu. I like Vera Tucker, Tippmann. They got some pieces there, and I like it. And he might go full receiver, and who knows where he ends up, and maybe things work out, and Garrett Wilson stays. But I still like the Jets situation personnel-wise. It's just a matter of who's the coach. So putting that aside, Vegas is intriguing as well because I think Brock Bowers is that quarterback-friendly. To where it's sometimes they say, you know, tight end is a quarterback's best friend. This is the best young tight end out there. So he's the bestest friend of a quarterback that comes in into the door, and he's a tight end. He can give you those easy completions, quick over the middle. He's a yak guy, so he can get you a lot of yards after contact and after the catch as well. Can make plays happen, so you don't always have to put them on the arms of your quarterback or the shoulders of your quarterback. No pun there. Those are the two that I still kind of like, but I have no idea what the coaching is going to look like. But to your point and to your data, they're going to get a fresh start with a new coach. So ideally, they're growing together, which appears to be the more statistically probable to hit and be a success versus the Giants, the Browns, the Titans with those coaching situations and already having the seat be scorching hot. And we're sitting here in January 2025.
Bowers is absolutely quarterback friendly, but also, like, don't forget, I don't think Jacoby Myers dropped a single pass this year. He had like over 100 targets and did not drop a pass. So, like, you're talking about very quarterback friendly receivers in Vegas there. Does Brady being there mean anything?
No, it doesn't mean anything. He's that's Twitter. People can argue about that. It doesn't mean anything to me. It's whatever.
Doesn't mean anything. All right. Okay. Anything else you want to talk about?
I mean, no, it's been a week, dude. It's been a week. It's been a week. I think I'm all tapped out other than, I guess, actually I want to say one thing. Yeah. Jerry Jones, like, if this is what you're going to do, like, I have a business proposition for Jerry Jones. Just go ahead and, like, start your own television network, like your own reality TV show network, you know, get a contract with YouTube TV and go ahead and just broadcast all the drama and reality TV shows that you want. You're clearly good at it, but this nonsense about Deion Sanders and maybe Jason Witten is like, what are you, Jason Witten? I love Jason Witten. Don't put me in a position to not like Jason Witten because you gave him a job he's not qualified for, because he's out there coaching high school football somewhere in Tennessee. And before even becoming the head coach at the University of Illinois, you're going to go ahead and make him the head coach of the Dallas Cowboys, the most valuable sports franchise in the entire world. And you're just sitting here loving it because you got tons of clicks and you're the first segment on First Take and all these other crazy shows that Joy Taylor apparently is still out there and just moderating still. I don't know what's going on there, but, like, just start your own. You're very good at this. You could stir the pot with the best of them. You are fantastic. Just start your own TV network. Call it what you want. You will get killer ratings, but don't pull your football team into it, because it's just, people want to win. People want to win. And that's not aligning with your behavior at this moment. And that's pretty sad that you're just going to potentially add more names to the list of wasted Hall of Fame careers, like DeMarcus Ware, Jason Witten, so on and so forth, that just never won a championship because you just couldn't get out of your own way. I really hope that doesn't happen to Micah Parsons, but boy, it's not looking good right now if the talk out there is true. So please just go into the Aaron Rodgers thing where he went into, like, the darkness for, do that, please. Just do that for a week. And then just come back after the coaching press conference, after the scouts have put together their boards, and just go in the dark. Just go in the dark and come back and go on Pat McAfee and talk about your experience. But stay away from the facility, please.
I get that there are some coaches that are meant for college football, right? Player development wise, they work better with young kids and, you know, people that don't necessarily make a lot of money. And they do well in that, in recruiting, getting people to sign up for your team. But, I mean, Deion did a pretty nice job with Colorado in terms of turning around a program that was irrelevant and making it very, very, very relevant, where, you know, the casual college football fan was intrigued, right? And you talked about Jerry Jones is a media guy. He loves that stuff. Like, he knows that that is a big reason why his team is the highest valued team in sports. I think Deion helps that, right? Like, you know, you're talking about a guy that, again, turned around a team. So he is a coach that has shown that he can win football games, but he also adds the circus a little bit and can help with getting your team in the paper. I don't know, man. I think that takes a really nasty turn if he says the only way I'm doing it is if you bring my son in, and then they figure out a way to make that happen and they get rid of Dak. Like, I would hate that. I would agree with you. I'd say that would be a terrible, terrible move. I don't know if that part's realistic, right? But if you just told me they were bringing in Deion, I don't know, man. I don't think it's that bad.
It's pretty freaking terrible. I could just imagine a Deion Sanders-led offense running out there, and you got Brian Flores on the headset on the opposing sideline calling. It's bad. It's bad. There's so many good candidates out there, and we're talking about a guy who won, what, 8 games at Colorado with the Heisman Trophy winner and perhaps the best quarterback in the class. And he it was the Big 12. Like, it wasn't even like he was in the SEC and won 8 games. And it's bad. It's not going to work.
All right, everyone. We'll put you out of your misery.
What a note.
Thank you all for tuning in. Give us a follow on Instagram, Facebook, TikTok, and X at @all22_PFF. Give us a review wherever you watch and listen to your podcast. Have a great rest of your day. I'm a ghost.